This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to be the Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we will dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at how on-site retail sales are booming as more and more people get vaccinated.
Plus, we dig into which industries will benefit most from President Biden's infrastructure plan.
But first, it's a major deal this week, Microsoft buying Nuance. It's a huge push into AI and telehealth for Microsoft. Anurag Rana joins us now. Now he heads up coverage there for Bloomberg Intelligence, senior technology analyst. Anurag, can you give us the basics, sort of what is Nuance, and then why would Microsoft want it?
So to go back 20 years, you know, Nuance had a software that would allow you to sit down and dictate, you know, letters and transcribe. But frankly, it wasn't very, you know, good at that point. But over the last, you could say, you know, decade or so, we have seen a massive improvement in transcription software. And I would say, I mean, one of the products that I saw on demo was launched last September, that Nuance software was just transcribing a telehealth session between a patient and a doctor. And that went pretty well. I mean, I think from there, that was a partnership they had with Microsoft using Microsoft Teams product. And I think the acquisition is just a natural progression of what Microsoft can do to with this technology going forward.
Yeah, it seems like strategically, it seems like a great move. It's obviously the healthcare space is huge in terms of total dollars, and you got to think it's going to be increasingly digitized here. Was there a lot of competition for this company? Because again, I've seen it and heard it described as really a very high quality technology.
Yeah, so Paul, you know, the funny thing is the first time I looked at this company many, many years ago, I thought of the same thing, that, wow, this is really cool. But frankly, the company always grew, I mean, one of 5%, 7%. So not unlike, you know, your normal cloud or AI companies growing, 50, 60, 70%. So it's just a matter of application of the software that they have and what you can do with it. And the other part is, you know, for example, I'm fairly certain that most large tech companies do have their own voice recognition software that they use for their product portfolio. What really caught my attention with Nuance is that their software products, which is actually doing well right now, the one we talked about, the healthcare one, you know, that embeds very well with electronic medical record companies such as Cerner and Epic. And to be honest, that's not an easy thing to do in the healthcare industry, is to look at different products that people are currently using and, you know, be part of it, just because there are so many compliance issues, so many regulatory issues. So I think that's really why they got into it. But I have a feeling that they're going to extend the use of it way more than healthcare.
How good is voice software now? I got to be honest with you. I really hate Echo. And I really hate, I mean, we call her Echo because I'm Alex and Alexa, we get confusing. But like, she gets it wrong every time. She doesn't understand my questions. I mean, like, it drives me bananas. Like, how good is this right now?
So Alex, let's go with the assumption it's not very good. Let's say it's 50% good or 60% good. Microsoft has the ability to make it, you know, far better. So that's, you know, one way to look at it. But the other reality is, I think it was a few years ago where all of these systems were able to understand as good as a human ear would. I would say this discovery happened, or this invention happened, almost about 3 to 4 years ago. So I think from that point of view, we are there at the, you know, we are over the curve. It could be, you know, I'm sure it's going to be a big problem with accents, big problem with other issues. But I think over time, just because that's kind of the loop of AI, it listens something, it learns, it makes a mistake, but then, you know, it fixes that problem and goes.
All right, let's step it back a little bit since we've got you here, Anurag. Let's talk Microsoft. This was a big deal from the market's perspective, $19.7 billion total enterprise value. So that certainly got the attention of M&A watchers. But for Microsoft, it's a drop in the bucket, you know, with an enterprise value of close to, you know, $2 trillion here for Microsoft. What's their M&A strategy here? They don't make a lot of deals because, quite frankly, I don't think much can really move the needle. How do they think about their M&A strategy?
Paul, I think you said it right. They don't make a lot of deals because none of those deals will really move the needle. But what they are looking for are technologies that can help them become far more effective in either a particular vertical or, you know, the products that they own. So if you go back, you know, there are two areas we have seen a fair amount of acquisitions over the last few years. Let's put LinkedIn aside for a second. And those have been, one has been on the security side. So they bought a bunch of security companies, and then they have enhanced their internal cloud products. They have enhanced their internal productivity products. Because what happens is, then they can go to the customer and say, hey, listen, you're using this version of the software. If you get the higher version of the software, it's far more secure, and it'll make your life a little bit easier. And the same thing goes for their cloud platform. And believe it or not, they have $10 billion in securities, revenue by now, which is more than any company that's out there. So that's one way to look at it. And the other one is when they, buy, they've also bought a bunch of things in the gaming world. They bought studios, they bought Minecraft, and that's an area also where they are expanding. So they look at big end markets and where they can buy either technologies or products which they can enhance over time.
So what are they going to buy next?
I think it's going to be a lot of these smaller things that enhance something or the other, whether it's an AI, security, and or gaming. Those three areas are the three big end markets.
Anurag, so great. I always learn a ton. Anurag Rana, Bloomberg Intelligence, Senior Technology Analyst.
Coming up on the program, how President Biden's infrastructure spending plan could be great news for construction and heavy machinery companies.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BIGO on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, fiscal stimulus is coming. It is here for many industries and upcoming. The next look is for stimulus that will drive infrastructure spending, get shovels in the ground. Let's talk about how that might play out. We welcome Nathan Dean. He's a senior government analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. All right, Nathan, the money's either here or it's coming. How big is this going to be for, let's say, some of these heavy machinery companies, some of these industrial companies, some of these companies that are really tied towards building things?
So, President Biden put out the opening salvo with his $2.25 trillion bill. We don't think that we are going to see passage for any package until probably September, but it's important to note that that $2.25 trillion number will change. As many people are aware, Congress writes the legislation, not the president, and so we're anticipating a bill coming out sometime in the next month or so, probably be multiple thousand page dollar bill, but you're looking at somewhere right between $2 to $2.5 trillion. It could go as high as $3 trillion, but our expectation is in that $2 to $2.5 trillion. And like you mentioned, pretty much there's a lot of industries here that are going to be benefiting from this. And you called out the heavy machinery firms. That's a great example to start with, because the way that this works is that it's not money going directly to companies, but majority of the people that are going to be able to tap into this are small contractors, your local mom-and-pop contractor that has been assigned to do a piece of road or a piece of bridge. However, they need equipment. And so our analysis shows that if this $2.25 trillion number comes in, if you're talking about Caterpillar, Oshkosh, Terex, Manitowoc, that industry is going to see somewhere between $68 billion to $90 billion in new sales. And if that $2.25 trillion number comes down a little bit, then you're probably looking at $38 to $40 billion in new sales over 8 years.
Do we have an understanding of how this will get spent? Like, is it, do you divide it by eight and then call it a day? Or how does infrastructure planning work on that end?
Okay, so if we take President Biden's $2.25 trillion bill, or his plan, $621 billion of that is earmarked for transportation. Now, that money gets doled out to existing funds, like the Highway Trust Fund, for example, or the Rural Development Fund. Those existing funds then dole out the money via contracts. Now, in terms of what information we have at the moment, President Biden has this 25-page plan. The White House just recently put out a fact sheet for each state and the District of Columbia saying, here's how much money we think this state needs. but then it goes to the funds and the agencies to actually dole that out. So in terms of timing, if this bill is passed in, say, September is our expectation, then you're probably seeing this money beginning to trickle out at the beginning of next year, and then the economic impact coming 6 to 9, 12 months after that to these companies.
All right, Nathan, you're down in D.C. You've got your finger on the pulse here. Is this thing going to get passed? Because we already see Republicans pushing back.
So the interesting thing is the Democrats don't need the Republicans on this. That being said, the Democrats have an extremely tight margin. They can only afford to lose 3 members in the House of Representatives, and they can't lose any in the Senate. And even though we have said that we think something is going to pass by September, the key word is something. There's going to be lots of negotiations that have to happen between now and then. Really important thing is going to be how you pay for this, the tax argument. In the House of Representatives, we already have 3 members on the Democratic side who say they won't support anything unless the SALT deductions are coming back.
Amen.
Great for people who live in, yeah, talking to your exactly, audience, man.
Exactly. For those of you who are in New York and New Jersey right now, this is great news. You've got Senator Joe Manchin in the Senate saying, I'm not going to support going to the corporate tax rate back to 28%. The general consensus in Washington is that the corporate tax rate would go to 25%. That would be the end game. But again, a lot of things can happen. A lot of lobbyists are talking to policymakers at the moment saying, hey, we want you to support this. We don't want you to support that. Or you need to insert this into the legislation and get this done.
So it does seem like one area that maybe it will have legs, it would be EVs. And I pause because I can imagine certain Republicans not being on board with that. But the private sector is already going there. So it feels like the wind's at that back. What kind of money are we talking about? And the infrastructure there is going to be a bit different.
That's right. And I don't want to say the Republicans are irrelevant to this debate, but President Biden has said we're just going to move forward, or at least he's hinted that we're moving forward without them. When it comes to the electric vehicle, there's really 2 angles to this. One is President Biden has called for 500,000 additional charging stations. So if I own an EV and I want to drive to New York, you know, if there's a lot more opportunities for me to stop and charge than the 3 that I saw the last time we tried it. The other thing is that the tax benefit. Now, the $7,500 tax benefit for buying an EV would actually be extended. Now, this is where it helps Tesla compared to Ford or GM or so forth like that, because going to EV all to itself helps all these automakers as it does. But the tax benefit, well, this is something that Tesla has used as its strategy mm-hmm. to get people to buy their cars. And so if this is extended, and we don't see any reason why it wouldn't be at this point, it certainly favors Tesla.
Boy, if I'm somebody who maybe was hesitant about supporting electric vehicles in this country, I got to start rethinking myself, because just in the last couple of months, we've seen the big U.S. auto manufacturers, GM and Ford and whatever the Fiat Chrysler is called now, really step up their EV game. We've had Volkswagen do the same over in Europe, and Volkswagen's the largest, you know, auto manufacturer. Boy, the tides have really changed here. I think I got to be behind this thing.
You're way behind, Paul. You're way behind. I'm not going to lie to you, man. You're way behind.
I know.
You know, but this is, you know, a lot of people were talking, you heard the phrase Green New Deal during the campaign, yep. Green New Deal. Well, this isn't the Green New Deal that we talked about last year, but it certainly is a Green New Thinking. This is something that President Biden and the Democrats have said, that if we proceed with an infrastructure package, it needs to take climate change into account. And the irony here is that, you know, in our analysis, there's like $30 billion in here earmarked for cleaning up abandoned mines and gas wells and so forth. And who does that favor? Halliburton. They're actually one of the biggest players in the U.S. when it comes to this. And so even they are going to get some of the benefit off of this green energy focus.
What other parts would qualify as sort of green energy, part of the Green New Deal? Because what I remember the rhetoric when this was first announced is that this wasn't a blockbuster full-on Green New Deal. This was a full-on infrastructure plan. What other parts are green?
There are new technologies that they want to put in place to the electric grids to actually try and make them more efficient. Our analyst there thinks that utility companies like American Electric and Xcel, plus there's a lot of R&D money that the bill would have for both the government agency as well as some academic research in terms of making technology more efficient.
All right, Nathan, thanks so much for that rundown. Infrastructure, it's coming. Questions, how do you pay for it? That's Nathan Dean, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Government Analyst.
Sorry, Nathan's just awesome. All right, coming up on the program, Turkish bank valuations at record lows. We're going to take a look at why.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BIGO on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We will be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Well, if you're playing the reflation trade, you want to look at banks. That's what's kind of done well over in Europe in certain areas. It's done well in the U.S. as the yield curve is deep. And one area where it most definitely has not done well is in Turkey. There's a 30% plus decline in Turkish bank shares this year. Does that actually get reversed? Joining us now, Tomas Netzel, BI industry analyst that covers banks. First of all, give us the background. Why have they been so bad?
At the beginning of the year, or even 3 weeks ago, the outlook for Turkish banks was very positive. The industry had very good prospects. Lira was one of the best EM currency. Banks were up more than 40%, recovering the ground lost in 2020. Unfortunately, on 19th and 20th of March, there were quite unexpected changes at the central bank, which totally ruined whatever the previous governor has achieved, which is the credibility of policymaking in Turkey. Since then, we have a new governor. We have no idea what's going to happen with the inflation, what's going to happen with the rates, what will be the policy framework in the coming months, and how it will impact the most important thing in Turkey, which is taming the inflation. This is not good news for the banks, because we're going to see pressure on asset quality, we're going to see pressure on margins, and most importantly, we're going to see pressure on refinancing, which is a very important aspect for Turkish banks.
All right, so talk to us about the central bank here in Turkey, Tomas. Most of the listeners don't have a good handle on that. Here in the States, we had a very accommodative Federal Reserve. Talk to us about what's happening in Turkey.
Okay, so first of all, Paul, I have to learn central bank governance every 6 or 8 months. I think this is already fourth or third governor since 2018, so we have a lot of changes over there, which is not very good for credibility and unpredictability of policymaking, which is very important for the banking sector, for the economy, especially during such difficult times as right now, post-COVID-19 recovery. What is happening in Turkey? We have massive political interference and massive political pressure on central bank to lower interest rates to tame inflation, right? This is very much opposite what you read in macroeconomic books. Low inflation will lead to low rates will lead to low inflation, right? It's working opposite, right? You have to have high rates to lower the inflation. Unfortunately, in Turkey, they are pushing for this idea to do it other way around, and the market doesn't seem to believe in it, which is causing a lot of the troubles for the lira, for the rate, and the outlook. So predictability and credibility of the central bank is, again, at a very low level. And really, it would be a very massive task for the new governor to regain this credibility.
I just don't see a scenario where Erdogan still runs the country where you can get higher rates and you can tame inflation and the banks do find that macro support. Like, under what scenario could that ever happen?
Well, it is very complicated, right? Erdogan has been in the power for many years. He has consolidated the power in Turkey. His party is really very large support from the Turkish residents. So it's going to be very tough and it's going to be very, very difficult this situation. But the best case scenario for the banks, to be honest, would be if you have higher rates for a longer period of time. We see the lira appreciation against the dollar. We see the rates at some time going down, and it's going to be good for the banks. Nevertheless, having said that, if you look at the Turkey from 2016 when the coup attempt happened during the summertime, then you had another crisis in 2017 leading to lira crisis in 2018. Then you had another crisis, lira crisis in 2020. If you look at the banks, they have been quite proactive and they manage very well all these turbulences. They manage the quality, asset quality very well. The regulation in Turkey is quite good in terms of capital, preserving the capital, in terms of asset quality, in terms of not exposing the banking sector to lira volatility. So the banking sector is very well prepared to weather the storm, right? In the long term, in medium term, of course, it's not good for the investor who doesn't like the roller coaster
All right. How about just the underlying business of the country of Turkey? You know, how has the Turkish economy dealt with the pandemic and the expectation for some type of reopening this year?
Yeah, so if you look at the COVID-19 impact on Turkey, so Turkey is one of the few economies which actually has grown GDP or expanded in 2020. However, maybe it looks good on paper. In order to achieve that, the bank, the governor of the central bank, and the regulators and government, they were pushing out banks to lend as much as they can. So we have seen state-owned banks lending 50-60% growth rate in 2020, which is quite massive. And whenever there is a massive loan growth during the pandemic period or the period of crisis, we never know what's going to happen with the asset quality and how it will fire back. So it can come at cost of higher asset quality problems in the future, but it has definitely helped the economy to deliver positive growth in very difficult 2020.
Really appreciate it, Tomas Nutzel, Bloomberg Intelligence Bank Analyst.
Coming up on the program, as more people start getting vaccinated, in-store retail sales, guess what? They're booming.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We're spending. We got stimulus checks, we got jobs, we got paychecks. We are spending money, and that's turning into apparel sales, jumping almost 50% from March 3rd to the 25th. And that means an overall gain in transactions of about 37%. Let's get through the data with Poonam Goyal, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst covering retail for us. Poonam, walk us through sort of where we're spending.
Yeah, it looks like consumers are spending again. Part of it is stimulus-driven. If you look at the March numbers that we got from Pfizer, retail sales were up nicely for the month, the preliminary numbers. But what's more interesting is if you look at it on a two-year basis, right, compared against 2019, and there the numbers still show positive growth, so it's encouraging. And part of our read is that is stimulus-driven. The results are just only going to get better as we move forward, especially into April, where the comparisons are the easiest. So we think you'll start to see an acceleration beyond March as we move forward.
All right. So, Poonam, it's strange in this country that there's different regional aspects to the reopening trade, if you will. Texas is obviously much more open than, say, the state of New York, which is reopening. So are we seeing regional differences in the retail sales as they come in?
Absolutely. So if you know, you just talked about Texas, Texas sales actually climbed 7.9% in the March period. And then you saw a 19.5% increase in Dallas. New York City was one of the cities where, you know, sales are still down. They're down 2.8%, but improving from the prior month's 10.8% drop. So we're definitely seeing things rebound as cities open up. Those cities are recovering faster, and they'll probably continue to be the trend in the coming months.
What makes us think that this just won't be buy now and that's it? So twofold. One, as economies reopen and the money goes to services rather than goods, or like how many pairs of jeans can you actually buy? Like, I feel like you can be skeptical in both directions.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's two ways of looking at this. You know, as the economy opens up, I think you are going to start to see people travel more, eat out more, do those things that they couldn't do for the last year. But at the same time, when you talk about purchasing goods, there are goods that people weren't buying last year. So last year was about buying comfortable wear. So whether it was athletic wear or your, you know, casual wear. What I think you'll see as you move forward and the economy's open is more structured apparel sales. So you will be going out more. Dresses could come back. You'll start to, you know, be more social, which means that you won't want to be in the same outfit every single time. So we do expect clothing sales to actually tick up as they were depressed last year outside of activewear.
How about grocery sales? It seems like they're going to have tough comparisons, you know, really throughout this year, because in 2020, we were all going to the store more. We were all eating in more. Is that going to be tough for the grocers?
Yeah, it is. And we're already starting to see that in the numbers, right? If you look at the numbers from March 3rd through the 18th, grocery sales actually fell 23.1%. Now, that's expected because we did have that surge last year as everyone was stocking up and obviously stores were closing but we do think that will be the case. That said, though, you know, grocery is undergoing a structural change where there has been a shift to online, whether it's buy online, pick up at the curb, or in the store. And we expect that shift to continue as we move forward.
What kind of different consumption habits are you going to be monitoring over the next, like, 6 to 12 months? And, like, I literally stopped buying clothes, and I have only bought things for my apartment. Now, I don't know how long that's going to go on for, but Bloomingdale's is going to be real sad about that.
See, once you start to go out, I do think that you will start to buy apparel again. It's just a matter of us, you know, moving out of our houses and into the real world again. So as we do that, we will spend more on apparel. As far as the home sector is concerned, you know, I wouldn't be too negative on that either, because I do think that where we are today with the macroeconomic trends, people moving out into bigger homes just after COVID, you know, moving out of cities and stuff, and people just refurnishing their spaces as they've spent so much time in it, they've learned of different areas that they could redress. And I think that trend will continue to still help home, even as we start to go out more this year.
So as we, quote unquote, go out more and we shop, is store traffic going to pick up meaningfully, or is the accelerated e-commerce trends that we saw over the past 12 to 18 months, is that permanent, do you think?
I think both. So you are going to see a sharp acceleration in store traffic against last year's numbers. But if you were to actually go back and look at it against 2019, you'll see that traffic is still down, which is what we saw in March. So even though you see triple-digit or high double-digit increases in traffic, the absolute number against 2019 is still down. And that's because of the digital shift, right? So we are going to see people continue to shop online. That's not going to revert all of a sudden because stores reopen or you can go out more. And that's something that's here to stay in our view.
What's so weird is I thought I shopped online primarily before, but now I see it even more. Like, I'll go to a store, check out stuff I may like, and then go buy it online anyway because, like, I'm going to get better deals or it's easier or whatever. It's kind of crazy. Say, Poonam, so what stocks do you own for this? Like, what companies are benefiting?
Yeah, I mean, the companies that will benefit this year will be the companies that didn't benefit last year, right? So if you're looking for where companies could see higher sales, I'd look at the apparel retailers, whether that's a Kohl's, whether that is someone like an American Eagle, or if you were even to go beyond that, you know, the online retailers still look to be gaining revenues, whether it's Amazon, Wayfair. We're still pretty positive on their top-line trends and think that they'll continue to pull market share. So it's a story of market share gains, and we think digital retailers and retailers that are differentiated, such as a Kohl's, such as a Wayfair, such as Amazon, will continue to benefit from the rising tide of online as well as differentiated products.
All right, Poonam, thanks a lot. We really appreciate it. Poonam Goyal, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Retail Analyst.
Coca-Cola, that is my soda of choice, Alex. I'm a big Coca-Cola fan. And Coca-Cola's got a big operation down in Latin America, Coca-Cola FEMSA. Let's get the latest on what's going on with that business. For that, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Consumer Products Analyst Ken Che. All right, Ken, so Coca-Cola, it's Coca-Cola FEMSA down in Mexico. Give us an overview of how that business is performing.
Yeah, hi, Paul. Yeah, Coca-Cola FEMSA is arguably the most important bottler within the vast global Coca-Cola system, as I see it. It's one of four super bottlers, as Coca-Cola would say, meaning they're really important. and it's really the key play in Latin America in terms of beverages. I mean, this is an area that is just immense population-wise. I mean, this company's exclusive territory is enormous, 265 million people throughout Mexico, Central America, and South America. So it's clearly a play on the attractive long-term demographics of Latin America.
Here's a really basic question. How much soda does Latin America actually drink?
A lot.
Oh, yeah? Okay, I didn't know that.
The Latin America soft drink market's about $76 billion at retail. It's the highest of all the major regions, as Coca-Cola sees it. And that's because the per capita consumption in Mexico is the highest in the world.
Wow.
A lot has to do with Coca-Cola's long-standing market presence in the area. They are by far the market leader down there. It's an affordable luxury, and the population loves it. So it's a really good market for Coca-Cola.
Yeah, Alex, on Ken's dashboard, his beverage industry dashboard, which has tons of data, he's got broken down by country, by year. It's unbelievable, the data he has. So when you ask him, you know, how big is the market, he can tell you in 20 different ways, but it's big. Ken, talk to us about the past, you know, 12 to 14 months with the pandemic. How has that impacted, you know, the consumer down and consumer spending and on things like Coca-Cola?
Yeah, Paul, you know, that's a really good question. You know, going into the pandemic first quarter last year, there was a lot of pessimism, you know, looking at companies like this. It's already an economically challenged area. Purchasing power is low. Economies were also very fragile. And then the pandemic hits. And, you know, coming out of it, you know, a year later, we're looking back. We're saying, you know, my goodness, Coca-Cola FEMSA, if this one word described it, it was resilient. Mm-hmm. You know, in spite of all the challenges with this pandemic and the economies, which were down last year, their total revenues were down only 6%, reflecting about a 2.5% sales volume decline, and only about a 1% decline in carbonates. I mean, it's really unbelievable how well they did. You know, a lot of it is because they've been there a long time. While pandemics may be somewhat new to them, economic volatility is not, and so they really executed well in the marketplace by coming out with things like direct to consumer. Really establishing a really strong online presence, coming out with affordable packaging, refillable bottles, things like that really added to the resilience of this company during the year.
What's the competitive landscape for Coca-Cola in Mexico and Latin America? Is it a Coke-Pepsi war like it is here in the U.S.?
It's really a one-sided battle. Coca-Cola, you know, has a two-thirds or so market share dominance in most of the Latin American regions.
Wow.
And it's just been there so long. And, you know, it's also the way that Coca-Cola has established its presence in these markets. That is, it has a system whereby Coca-Cola, the franchise company in Atlanta, sells its syrups to these big bottlers. So it doesn't own them outright, but it has a minority interest and a board representation that allows these companies to expand with Coca-Cola's help in these areas in a very capital-intensive way without hurting the balance sheet to the parent company, the United States. PepsiCo goes about it differently. PepsiCo looks at it much more asset-light. They would rather just partner with different companies and basically license the PepsiCo name. So it's a different strategy.
Ken, it's always good to catch up with you. Thank you so very much. Ken Shea, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Consumer Products Analyst.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.